Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 89, section 4, which is old single column, page 977. Okay. Remember, as we were sort of pointing out towards the end of the preceding session, this is a long story in this paper, building up to sort of that full abstraction of the atonement doctrine. And obviously, you have to have the concept of sin. So remember, first, you've got to get the predicate to the historic definition of sin, transgression of taboo. You've got to talk about taboo. Then remember, we talked about sin proper, in terms of transgression of taboo. Then we started getting into the beginning notions of playing with that new concept. Look at the title of section 3 there, Renunciation and Humiliation. We were getting that concept that I so often bring up, that you start firing up a more definitive spiritual consciousness. And no matter how rudimentary and primitive, but definitive nonetheless, and it doesn't start out in a positive mode. It has to evolve into a more positive mode. It starts out in a very negative mode. We saw it with the thou shalt nots of the taboos, and just the concept of these self-negating ideas like renunciation, various ways that you're either trying to pull back on yourself. Remember we were talking about how we start seeing these RE prefixes in these religiosity technical terms that they keep throwing out in this paper. So they humans are feeling some sense of that of the RE prefix of religion, but they're not going back to eternity yet. But they are thinking that there's some sort of a back, and so they're going back in time, basically what they're thinking. Various schemes of imagining that, things rolled forward in time, and it's like if only there was a magical way to, roll things back as if none of that had ever happened. All right? So it's a temporal concept of back, to begin with. I mean, you've told, now you want to tell back, renounce, whatever it might be. You've got this resetting concept they're bringing in, but back to the main point. You're starting in a negative mode, remember, and they were pointing out that you're beginning to think about, what will eventually become a positive concept of self-control, but initially your sense of self-discipline is not in that proper positive mode of what you mean by self-control. It's self-denial. It's a negative mode. Right? And so everything is, your spiritual consciousness is an error and evil detector, and everything starts with you. Oh my goodness, there's just so many things about me that aren't as they should be. It's all playing into that animal guilt, and that becomes the nucleus of the animal nature that you build all of these religious notions about of sin and what have you. Right. So, but is there, about to point out, and as I was saying at the end last time, you, you know, if you start thinking about, you know, in various ways that you're going to put a bridle on yourself, take away from yourself, whatnot, you're obviously getting very close to some sort of very direct concept of sacrifice. Right? I mean, you're basically, that's what you're already thinking. I need to sacrifice in some way. And obviously, it won't take long, and you will make that very literal and overt, some sort of ritualistic thing in the outer life. And so that's the next step, is to get into sacrifice. And this is where it starts to get very gritty. Because, I mean, it was problematic enough when you, when you're thinking in very literal terms about the mortification of the flesh. Remember, we were talking about that, you know, where maybe you're, you know, hacking yourself with a knife or something, you know, to try to die to the flesh, quote unquote. But, you know, you start getting sacrificed, and okay, now it could obviously feed into, very, very stark concepts of human sacrifice. And they need to talk about human sacrifice, and so they have to talk about the predicate, the kind of the natural predicate for thinking in those terms of human sacrifice, cannibalism. Okay, so it's, you know, you're thinking you're heading towards this very refined atonement doctrine concept, but you can't get there except through unpacking some rather stark details about cannibalism. All right, so everyone, gird your loins, as it were, and we're gonna plow through this.
In the new Stay Fresh wrapper.
be forewarned. It can get very direct at times. Okay, let's see what they have to say.
Section 4, Origins of Sacrifice. Sacrifice, as a part of religious devotions, like many other worshipful rituals, did not have a simple and single origin. The tendency to bow down before power and to prostrate oneself in worshipful adoration in the presence of mystery is foreshadowed in the fawning of the dog before its master. It is but one step from the impulse of worship to the act of sacrifice. Primitive man gauged the value of his sacrifice by the pain which he suffered. When the idea of sacrifice first attached itself to religious ceremonial, no offering was contemplated which was not productive of pain. The first sacrifices were such acts as plucking hair, cutting the flesh, mutilations, knocking out teeth, and cutting off fingers. As civilization advanced, these crude concepts of sacrifice were elevated to the level of the rituals of self-abnegation, asceticism, fasting, deprivation, and the later Christian doctrine of sanctification through sorrow, suffering, and the mortification of the flesh.
Okay, so let's just go through it in order. Let's start up front there. I want you to remind yourself to not jump too far ahead. It's difficult enough, as we've talked about many times, when you see the word worship in these evolution of religion papers, to, you know, think in some advanced way about worship. It's going to be even more so if they say worshipful, like they did twice there. You notice that in the beginning of that paragraph. Remember what we're talking about. You know, you basically just have your sixth adjutant feeling of reverence. You may be bringing it to a focus on an individual's veneration. Okay, but we aren't talking about genuine worship, full. Okay, You know, just because it sounds like, oh, it's sounding like that holistic fullness, you know, in the upper domain when they say worship full, okay, it you feel very full inside, okay, but it's not a true fullness, it's a false fullness. And it is just, you know, these very rudimentary urges, basically, you know, with a little bit of rationalization thrown in. You know, to begin with, and you know, you can, you know, you're sort of being gently reminded of that, in just the fact that you know you have worshipful rituals, right? You know, or worshipful adoration, and right? You know, you're wanting to talk to some being, God, whatever. You know, and you're just adding all of this solemnness, you know, to it. Okay, so there's that. And, you know, just, you know, I mentioned it in my little preface. Remember, you have the animal origin guilt fact that you're exalting into a grand religious, you know, giving it grand religious significance. You know, and they're reminding you it's not just that animal fact. Right? All this stuff is foreshadowed by the fawning of the dog before its master, like they're saying. Again, all of these, you know, just like a dog can have that guilt, you know, the fawning, you know, is just like the prostrating. Right? These are, you can fool yourself if you get more and more sophisticated with all kinds of rationalization schemes, but basically, this stuff is just animal instincts that are happening. You know, that you're falling down and prostrating yourself, say, or what have you. You know, and even rudimentary prayer itself, remember, right, is purely biologic. It's just programmed. You're programmed like a machine by the life carriers to have that urge. Okay, so all of this is still, you know, is a far cry from anything that, you know, has a, can be easily recognized as a shadow of some superconscious thing above. It still is fun, you know, this is humans doing this, and so it really is always a shadow of the genuine facts that are superconsciously above. But as they're saying, pretty crude stuff to begin with. But then you see, you know, as they're going through all that stuff in the latter part of that paragraph, as we've seen over and over again, no matter how crude it starts out, it never stays crude, at least universally amongst all humans. It never stays crude. It always progressively gets more and more abstract. It will at the very least go from just sort of directly, simplistically, literally material in notion to something that's more mental. You know, you go from a religion of matter to a religion of mind. And so, you know, let's just look at some of those examples they give you. You know, you're heavy into this notion of pain. Yeah, with sacrifice, maybe just a little aside, you go, oh, pain. Yeah, pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution. See, it's not, the thought is not devoid. It's not utterly animalistic, right? There's a little bit of a recognition that pain is just kind of, you know, inescapably part of the process in an evolutionary domain. But you see there, so it goes from all this stuff like cutting off fingers and whatnot to, you know, to rituals of self-abnegation, asceticism, fasting, deprivation. See, and then getting even more abstract, like, you know, is what they're saying there. Later on, the sanctification through sorrow, suffering, and the mortification of the flesh. Yeah, we talked about that last time. I mean, mortify literally means to make dead. Mort is dead, the phi is make. You know, you heard me say, you know, quote unquote, dying to the flesh, you know, dying to the self, right? All those sorts of concepts of, you know, and getting more and more dichotomous, where the self is evil and, you know, some other notion is divine, and you know, and how problematic that is, because it isn't some other fact that's eventually going to be finitely divine. It's yourself, right? That's going to be finitely divine on the Isle of Paradise. Now, let's look at some of those, just, you know, to flesh it out a little bit. You notice that they brought in self-abnegation, you know, another way of you know, talking about things like self-denial or renunciation. You know, what's the difference in saying it that way, saying abnegation? Well, that ab prefix means from. So, you know, unlike just saying self-denial, say, saying self-abnegation, you know, emphasizes that something is being taken from you, right? You know, in the same sense of as, you know, deprivation, okay? You know, and you might say, well, what's the difference between self-abnegation, you know, self-denial sorts of notions, and asceticism? Well, first of all, there's the ism part. You know, it's not just, you know, some of it. You're trying to make a complete lifestyle solution out of self-denial. So obviously one of the first things that you're going to do if you're trying to make it the everything like that, make it an ism, you know, self-denial notions are going to tend to go to extremes. But it'll even go beyond that. You know, you won't, for instance, you won't just deny yourself fancy clothes. You will wear scratchy clothes. Okay? That's going to asceticism. Right, the hair shirt thing. Right? Right, so just, you know, I mean, and again, obviously, the more you get the zeal of the sixth adjutant, you know, fired up, the more it's going to take things to extremes like that. You know, and so, but just, you know, remember, we're thinking about the beginnings of sacrifice. We aren't literally, you know, burning cattle on an altar yet here or anything. We're, you know, you actually start with yourself, like you always do. Okay, I mean, you know, and from the moment that you're born and start to try to figure out what the outer life is about, you know, and you begin to get the concept that there's objects, right? The most fascinating object is you, you know, right? In the vast system of objects, you know, and most people go their entire life in that mode, right? The day they die, still the most fascinating object is themselves, okay? Whole life is just playing with themselves. And, you know, so, you know, it naturally starts out that way, but you'll, you know, as you get more sophisticated, you'll move on to other objects, and eventually you're sacrificing plant, you know, products and animal products, okay? But, you know, we're starting out with these things that are very kind of close to home, like fasting, you know, as a sacrifice. See, and then, you know, and then just, you know, those concepts that everyone is so familiar with and are so difficult to not have pollute the way you think about yourself religiously. I mean, you've been marinating in sorrow and suffering notions since the day you were born, right? And how the sanctification of such things, right? And, you know, everyone knows, you know, like some later Christian doctrine, I mean, the main reason that such notions became so exalted and sanctified in Christianity is because you've got to rationalize Jesus' suffering, right? You know, everything about him was innately divine, right? Therefore, his suffering must be divine. And so if you, you know, to be godlike, you know, is to be, you know, equally suffering. And you know, that whole rationalization scheme to try to make sense out of Jesus' life. But, you know, as they're pointing out, that isn't out of the blue. That's just part of the ever developing spectrum of sacrificial notion. Okay.
But there must be some kind of honor or something in that. I mean,
see, there must be some honor or something. Well, see, I mean, that we
for a second.
Yeah, I know.
But like those guys that go around hitting themselves.
Yeah, right,
and
right.
All that kind of stuff. I mean, they're trying to immolate Jesus. So
they're
has to be
they're trying to purge themselves. See, that's mortification of the flesh.
Okay.
See, all right? You know, you're whipping yourself. Maybe you even use, you know, a cat of nine tails, you know, to try to be very Jesus-like. Rip chunks of flesh out of your back. All right. But again, see, all of that is false. Right? It doesn't matter how much we feel it's valid, which is completely natural. A million years of natural, you know, quote-unquote validity, you know, and the way we feel about such things, you know, but it's just like Jesus' point. He kept trying to get people to figure out that God is your spiritual father. And spirit has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with matter. Your body's matter. Right? There is no such thing as a sanctification of any material fact or notion. Right? That's the ghost cult, where the spirit domain is the illusory extrapolation of the material domain. Right? And so there's naturally all this linkage between the material and the quote-unquote spiritual, because you defined the spiritual that way, as stemming from the material. Spiritual does not stem from the material. It is absolutely separated. There's an absolute anchor for spirit stuff separate from an absolute anchor for matter stuff. They don't. One doesn't stem from the other at all. Absolutely not. Right? Not just ultimately not. Absolutely not. Okay? And that's the challenge. It's very natural, as I was saying a minute ago, because you have a material mind and a material identity, you can't start with anything but a so-called religion of matter. And by nature, your mind is attuned to your biologic material nature. So inescapably, as you begin to abstract from a religion of matter, you go to a religion of material mind. And you can go up to all kinds of airy-fairy heights in your mind, but see, it's all just bottom-up, stemming from, in ever more illusory fashion, from matter. At some point, you have to stop that. Recognize that no matter how much you try to exalt that, you are still infinitely distant from spirit. The most highly exalted material notion in your mind, you know, hence, you know, mindal notion now, you may completely kind of sever it from any direct connection to matter, and it's just all totally a mindal, a religion of pure religion of mind notion. It's not spirit. Okay? You have to just stop that at some point, and that leap of faith thing, it's not a slither of faith. And it's a leap of faith. You're jumping across a chasm, an absolute divide between time and eternity, between matter and spirit. Okay? And there's nothing natural about that, proved by a million years have gone by and it hasn't happened yet. Right? It's obviously not natural. But it's... You must do it. Let me just say it that way. You know, use the Revelator's must term. Right? To get to the religion of the Spirit, you must completely let go of the entire history of religious thought and everything that happens naturally within you with your sixth adjutant. You have to just completely step apart from that. It's don't expect to be successful, probably in this life. But set your sight to that goal, right? If what you're becoming day by day is eventually on one of the mansion worlds, you actually take that step, okay, then what you are now is of value when that's your eventual destiny. But if your destiny is absolutely fixed by your free will to be the most exalted material extrapolation that you can come up with, then you're vainly hoping for the future. You don't really have a future then. You'll never have a spirit identity that can leave the local universe. So, that's the challenge.
I can see, though, that there's the level of the flesh, okay?
Right.
And the level of the feelings, the mental level of the mind. Well, these people here, these, not the ones on the top, but the one on the top with the Christian doctrine, these guys that I was talking about. So here, spirit of courage. That's in your spirit box. So that's loyalty.
Yeah, but that's on the level of the flesh.
But that's what they have to go through the flesh
first. I'm not saying.
A million times.
See, again, that's what we talked about last time. That whole bit of dying to the flesh is not appropriate. In this life perforce, you serve two masters. I mean, Jesus didn't tell you to spit in Caesar's face in order to get true religion, right? He said, rend unto Caesar's what is Caesar's and unto God's what is God's, right? I'm just reminding you that what's God's is absolutely separate from what's Caesar's. And trying to take Caesar's stuff, matter, and making a religion out of it is a fool's errand, right? And the degree to which we've kind of fallen back into that natural state, that's why all the mainline churches have gone back to social justice, right, is a material concept again. There's no effort to try to get to spirit. Right, and that only lasts for a little while, and kind of churches just disappear, and everyone is just, well, why do you need churches for social justice? Isn't politics the appropriate sphere for social justice? Yeah, and so politics becomes a new religion. Okay, and it's very definitively a religion of matter now again, right? Because politics is about rearranging matter. Okay, not about being born again. Right? So, yeah, but that doesn't mean there isn't a very important place for true politics, true government. We talk about that stuff all the time in the book. That's why there's a civilizational emergency, okay? But you have to just keep them separate, right? Separation of church and state is, separation of inner life from outer life. Religion is purely inner life. And your genuine upper domain inner life has no relationship whatsoever to the matter out there or your feelings about the matter out there. That's the thing that we're trying to get at, right? That's the domain of genuine religion, something that's bound back to eternity. If your so-called religious thought, if you stop and think, well, is that a temporal issue? Oh, yeah, it is. Okay, well, then it's not genuinely religious. If it has anything to do with time, it's not religious. God saving me in time. That's not religion. Just because you are trying to make the magic man save you in time doesn't make it religion. Right? Let's just keep that in mind. Pardon the pun. Anyway, back to the topic at hand. It is the case that when you get to these fancier concepts, like suffering, You know, let's not lose sight of the fact that these are humans that are doing this. This isn't pure, literally fancy animals. An animal can't suffer. Right? Animal feels pain, but in order to experience suffering or feel what we call suffering, you have to have that upper domain objectivity where you're looking down on the pain and suffering relative to it. Right? If you're in the pain, you can't suffer. You're just in pain. Literally, you're in pain. You're down in the lower domain where the pain is. You're in it. Right? You have to get a little bit above the pain in order to suffer. And the animal can't get above its pain. So, I mean, there is, see, you have one, maybe your big toe, right, in the upper domain, in order to get to these concepts of sorrow, suffering, and the mortification of the flesh, right? There's a little bit of top-down play there. But not all the way, obviously, because you're still very much fixated on all these temporal issues. You haven't gone all the way up to the ceiling in the upper domain. Okay.
So I can just stub my toe and not really have to wash my feet to be clean.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to remind yourself of something in the religion papers, it's kind of parallel to what I was just saying. Remember those four philosophic levels? Right. And, in order to get these Christian theological notions, for instance, you have to have at least a handful of church leaders that are on the third philosophic level. To actually get up to that fourth philosophic level, you're going to look long and hard to find someone there.
Tell me what those four levels are.
The levels are not important. We don't want to go way off on that tangent, but I just wanted to focus on the top two levels. We don't have to figure out how to get there yet. The contrast, it's only on the fourth level that you can do fear not, as they say there in that paper. All right. It's only then when you get all the way up to that fully objective level that you can finally do what Jesus said was step one. What he was, in terms of what he wanted you to do, found a religion of the Spirit, based upon a spiritual father, right, and a genuine spiritual consciousness on the spiritual level, the sixth level of meaning, genuine God knowingness. Genuine religious consciousness. It's only when you're up totally that point where he said is your beginning that you can fear not. And like I just said, I mean, they tell you, as you're reading through that, you got most people that are kind of just fine, on the first level, taking things as they are. The second level, they bring in a couple little additional things and then they're satisfied. Right? The third level, they're bringing in a little bit of the first cosmic intuition, a little bit of causal consciousness and stuff, a little bit of self-consciousness. But the fourth level, no. Right? Basically, no one has been able to get there. No one's been able to get to Jesus' beginning point consciously. Remember, this is all consciously. Right? Super consciously. These guys that are cutting off their fingers in the name of religion, we're calling it religious because super consciously they're genuinely religious. Although obviously consciously they're far from it. Right? They're cutting off their fingers for Pete's sake. But super consciously by grace, we're genuinely religious. Post-Pentecost, we even get an adjuster and a soul. Right? You're still cutting your fingers off in the name of, the devotion to God. Don't think that aren't people still doing it on the planet. Go to India, right? There's still people doing all those kinds of things. And it's post-Pentecost, right? So they have an adjuster and a soul and the spirit of truth and everything, but consciously they're still, poking sharp rods through their cheeks and crawling, you know, 5 miles, you know, and bloodying their knees or something, you know, in the name of God. All right, let's get a little bit more here.
Early in the evolution of religion, there existed two conceptions of the sacrifice. The idea of the gift sacrifice, which connoted the attitude of thanksgiving, and the debt sacrifice, which embraced the idea of redemption. Later, there developed the notion of substitution.
Now, that's an important statement. You know, say, just made it just that one little tiny statement as its own paragraph. We aren't totally hopeless by nature. That's why Jesus told you you can get on the correct path by entering the kingdom of heaven as a little child. So you go back to the little children in the beginning, early in the evolution of religion, and do you find purely negative? No, not purely negative, right? You don't just have the debt sacrifice. Actually, the humble little child will be immediately inclined to the gift sacrifice, to want to sacrifice in the name of thanksgiving. It's only when you get more sophisticated and you dream up all these schemes that you really get into the whole negative mode of debt sacrifice. You know, I'm by nature sinful and unclean. No little child thinks they're by nature sinful and unclean. That takes a so-called adult, right, to get wrapped around the axle like that. All right, so just, you know, notice that it was there, but it was very difficult for humans to hold on to thanksgiving, right? Because guilt, animal guilt, is the foundation of all this. Right? See, so no matter, you know, it's like, I have an urge to be thankful. Then they start thinking about it, except now when I think about it, oh no, I should be guilty. That's what's going on. You know, that's what's always been going on. But it is encouraging to see that what Jesus was saying was not foolishness. There is an innocent little child there that you can go back to who doesn't have a hold of guilt. Matter of fact, they've naturally used their prayer urge to actually start to play with thanksgiving above it. How's that for grace? Right? In the little child. Go back to that. Forget about the guilt stuff. Right? There is no reality to guilt in eternity. You know, and then you can see the fact that the debt sacrifice stuff is where you're befogged by much thinking, because then you get even wheels within wheels. Ooh, and later there developed the notion of substitution. I mean, you know, you're just, this is, you know, biologic adults, you know, thinking too much, coming up with all these, oh, you know, I could actually substitute that for that, and that would be just as effective. And eventually you can have Jesus substituting for all sacrifice, of course. All right, so Jesus, the understanding of Jesus becomes the ultimate conception of this false tangent. As far removed from thanksgiving as you can get. You took the other path. And the fork in the road was there. Do I go to thanksgiving and eventually get to the God of love? Or do I take this path and I eventually get to the whole atonement doctrine and rationalization of Jesus' life? All right. So, like I said, that's an important thing. They just, you know, we're immediately going to not talk about all the negative stuff. You know, Thanksgiving is going to disappear because it was only there for a brief moment, and then everyone got much more fascinated with darkness. You know, demons are always more interesting than angels, for instance. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, keep going.
Man still later conceived that his sacrifice, of whatever nature, might function as a message bearer to the gods. It might be as a sweet savor in the nostrils of deity. This brought incense and other aesthetic features of sacrificial rituals, which developed into sacrificial feasting, in time becoming increasingly elaborate and ornate.
Because that's what the sixth adjutant drives you to, right? So, just reminding you that, as soon as you start down this path, it just keeps getting fancier and fancier the more you think about it. And you're like, now I think about it, it makes complete sense that one of the key things about, Cain or Abel's sacrifice is that the smoke goes up and is, and God breathes it in, because after all, he's the breath of life, right? So he breathes it in, and it's a sweet savor in the nostrils of Yahweh. Right? And that just brings in, we could make it all the fancier by having incense and we just get all of these notions, and boy, it's the room is really spiritual if there's incense burning. Right? It sanctifies the room.
I hate it.
Yes.
Never sitting down the middle of the aisle again.
Let's spread that incense around with that tin can.
Who picked the smells?
Yes, right. Notice that, the rationalizations get fancier. It's like, I really like to eat. Let's come up with a notion that, if the smell is getting to God, well, the actual eating gets to God too. So if we eat in the name of God, it's like, well, how do you think that's? The wealthy guy that's throwing this ever more elaborate feast, has to cough up major bucks, right? He's down several G notes, right, to make it happen. That's the scheme, and obviously that feeds right into philanthropy, and redistribution of wealth is right, all that sort of stuff. See, all starts with the concept of sacrifice. All right.
Sacrificing other people.
Eventually, right. See, again, substitution. See, there's a further on scheme. It's like, I could substitute someone else's wealth for my wealth. Yeah, that would be even more sacred. Because after all, Jesus was the supreme substitute. See, this is the way we think. That happens naturally.
You run out of other people.
Eventually, you run out of other people's wealth, yes, but right, that's what's going on. Yep.
As religion evolved, the sacrificial rites of conciliation and propitiation replaced the older methods of avoidance, placation, and exorcism.
Talk about a mini little paragraph there. Again, see, just to get you, I've already stressed this. The point is, it starts out negative, right, and then starts to move more positive. So you start out with the negativity of avoidance, placation, and exorcism. Remember, placation is you've got a very angry spirit or God. It's okay, you play soothing music or something, and he stops throwing thunderbolts or whatever. Okay, you placate the gods. So you go from those negative things of like the negativity of avoidance or the negativity of exercise, driving out a bad spirit, to conciliation and propitiation. Remember, in the foundational one there is propitiation. To think of the pro prefix to just kind of remind you what's going on. You're trying to move things forward, okay? And you'd like to use a spirit or a god to that end of moving what you're interested in forward. Right? Propitiation.
So.
Right, you're not just trying to placate, right, get things to a neutral state. You're trying to flip things into, so that things are working in your favor, not just neutral. Okay, and conciliation is just kind of adding to it. You're not just going to get, God say to, be favorable to your ends, but you're going to get God together with you, right? The con part, the togetherness of that word, right? We're together in this grand venture for my selfish ends, Lord, right?
Which is, that's
the
truth.
Oh, yeah, right. See, again, there's a truth to this, and even apart from the truth, it's like, well, it's a positive step forward. Okay, see, like you're pointing out, it's not purely negative. At least you're, even if it's totally selfishly positive, at least it's flipping positive. We can mature that. It can get it better, you know, with time. It's once you get to propitiation, as I'll point out here in a few paragraphs, that's we start to get all fancy with all kinds of concepts with that. All right, what do they say here?
The earliest idea of the sacrifice was that of a neutrality assessment levied by ancestral spirits. Only later did the idea of atonement develop. As man got away from the notion of the evolutionary origin of the race, as the traditions of the days of the planetary prince and the sojourn of Adam filtered down through time, the concept of sin and of original sin became widespread, so that sacrifice for accidental and personal sin evolved into the doctrine of sacrifice for the atonement of racial sin. The atonement of the sacrifice was a blanket insurance device which covered even the resentment and jealousy of an unknown God.
See, the fancier it gets, the more imaginarily effective it becomes, of course. But you know, see, you see it right there, what I was just saying about the preceding little paragraph. You start out just trying to neutralize things. See, in a neutrality assessment, right? But the interesting thing they're throwing in there is this actually, is leveraged, this evolutionary change is leveraged by the prince and his staff and Adam and Eve. And because of the rebellion and the fault, you just have these vague memories of those and the rationalizations that people dreamt up about, you know, what went on long ago, you know, that ends up with the fall of man and original sin and all that sort of stuff. See, if you hadn't had them, right, you wouldn't have needed Darwin in the 19th century, you know, so-called discovering evolution. No, that was rediscovering evolution, right? We naturally recognized it was self-evident. Evolution was self-evident to primitive man. It's only in the wake of Adam and Eve, most definitively, that we, lost that and went into this whole magical fiat sort of rationalization scheme. Okay, so that's an interesting little scientific sidelight to that. And notice another insidious thing here that they're emphasizing towards the end there. Genuine religion is purely individual, right? Because it's only in your inner life, which is absolutely unique, separate from anyone else's inner life, because your personality is absolutely unique. Right? So you actually were on a helpful beginning, no matter how primitive and superstitious and simplistic it was, but at least it was individualized. But then it starts to blur out into collectivism, okay? And culminating in, modern notions of collective salvation and stuff, for instance. Okay? Which means I'll give you the benefit of the doubt and I'll say you're spiritual, but you're definitely not religious, right? Because you've de-individuated it. That's the insidious thing about bias towards your unity consciousness, getting you to collectivism and stuff. It blurs out the individual, which means it blurs out your personality, which means it separates you from God. Right? Your only way to get to God is via that absolutely unique personality grasp. And you're not going to get it down in the lower domain in the horde, washed out in the horde. Right, so you see there's a number of insidious things that the rebellion and the default led to. There's kind of what they're giving you between the lines. We've been struggling to individuate in our religious sense.
When it says the doctrine of sacrifice for the atonement of racial sin, it kind of reminds me, like, it's like they knew what was going to be happening in 2019, because now that people are wanting to atone for racial sin, like to the black people or to the Indians or whatever.
Right. Again,
that's how I take it.
Right, of course. I mean, like I've been saying it several times. I mean, notice how, you know, it is automatically going to get into sociology, politics, and economics when it ceases to be genuinely individuated and religious. And so, right, it you just get all of these secular schemes as the new domain for rationalizing these, these rudimentary religious notions like atonement, right? You're not going to, you'll think you're, well, I've totally thrown out religion, so obviously I've thrown out the atonement doctrine. Yeah, sure you have. No, you're just going to transfer some atonement doctrine to some social notion, right? That's because it's natural. All the stuff we're reading about is just inescapably natural. You will come up with taboo. You will come up with sin relative to that taboo. You will come up with atonement relative to that sin. You can't do anything else. Right? And so when we erase the old notions, and at the beginning of the 20th century, we had a brief little period where we didn't, we were just in the undefined fuzzy domain where we'd let go of all notions of morality, because that was all just, made up stuff, we decided. But of course, it's not going to stay away. It's going to recoalesce. And so it starts with the concept of correctness. Okay, it's not going to be religious correctness now, because you threw that out. It's going to be, a secular thing. It's going to be political correctness, right? And remember, righteousness is defined as correct understanding. So it won't take them long. It won't just be merely the correct thing to do politically. They will use the word moral to describe it. And that's started up here in just recent years. They're starting to use this new secular religious notion, this religion of matter, right, is redefining the term morality. Everyone is using that now again. In other words, they're redefining taboos. They're not just, you shouldn't do that because it's not PC. No, it's wrong to do that. It's a sin to do that because that's a taboo. That's taboo behavior, right? So they start talking about morality, right? And then they'll start to talk about what you're going to have to do to atone for, the racial sin. Why is the country going to hell in a handbasket? Well, because, we're beset with this sin, right? And until we all change, we won't be at one again. I'm sure you've already kind of heard that. Mm-hmm, see? Sure. It's all there. It can't help but be there. But now it doesn't have, even the pretense of being about God. Right?
Not now.
Because it's humanism now.
They're taking God out.
Right, because it's humanism. Right? To man be the glory, not to God be the glory. Right? But, remember, but that's the way it started long ago. I mean, it'll be like this, for a while. I mean, civilization will collapse and everything. But over time, we'll dream up a God notion again, and we'll start worshiping that newfound God notion. We'll go through the whole process again. But, do you really want to go through that whole million-year process again? Right? At the very least, we ought to see if we could get back to the God notions that we started throwing out at the beginning of the 20th century, as superstitious and primitive as they might be. Okay, at least there was a God attempt to try to seek something called God, not just the exaltation of man. And now let's use our our less superstitious, more our post-enlightenment minds, right, to search for the real God, right? And you can occasionally hear someone say that. It's like, you know, don't judge, you know, they might say, don't judge the Catholic Church by the silly notions of God or the behaviors of the people that profess to be followers of God. I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with the real God. Right? You can occasionally hear that. Not often, but occasionally. See, there's not everyone is forgotten, right? That as hopeless as man is, it doesn't define the nature of God. You know, even recognizing that all of the kind of historical notions of God were sort of defined by hopeless humans and were anthropomorphic, you know, they still knew that, you know, that sometime in the distant future, their people would strive for the real God. And they were trying to do that.
You know, I used to read this and it never hit home. But now, everything that it says is kind of, you know, like where we're at.
Yeah, that's the point I've been trying to make as we've been going through these evolutionary religion papers, is it not? Right? I mean, to see that it appears on the surface to be talking about what was going on a long time ago, the evolution of religion. No, it's talking about what's going on today, right before your very eyes. Almost every page is just exactly what you can see on the news and hear a politician say. Right? You're watching it happen. You know, and if it becomes systemic, then civilization collapses. You know, and we won't just be paralleling the essence of what we're reading here. We'll drop right back down into the substance of what we're reading here. Right? That's what the book is here for, you know, saying you could drop back into the substance of this. And, all right. What else do they have to say here?
Surrounded by so many sensitive spirits and grasping gods, primitive man was face to face with such a host of creditor deities that it required all the priests, ritual, and sacrifices throughout an entire lifetime to get him out of spiritual debt. The doctrine of original sin or racial guilt started every person out in serious debt to the spirit powers.
Just, you know, not belabor it, but just notice between the lines, surrounded by so many sensitive people and grasping leaders, right, because that's humanism now, and, you know, everything's an offense. Everyone is sensitive, and right, and you're constantly trying to do all these things. Your life is just becoming bogged down and trying to, you know, seek forgiveness, you know, for offending that person. And see, we're in the exact same mode. Exact same mode. Primitive was face to face with such a host of creditor deities, right? Creditor, you know. Humans, it's like, oh man, I mean, now I'm in debt to you because, you know, I shouldn't have tweeted that. Oh, that was just so horrible or whatever, right? They required all the priests, ritual, and sacrifices throughout an entire lifetime to get him out of spiritual debt.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing.
All right. Okay.
There is a jail in
there. Right. It's all playing out right before your eyes. You know, and see, just notice how they're stressing at the end. You know, we haven't fully, you know, reconstituted this to this full exaltation of guilt again, where, you know, I am by nature offensive to others, you know, and we're all just born in the original of sin of offending others. You know, we haven't fully religiousized it again. But, you know, give it at most 5 years. Right? I mean, it's happening so fast right before your eyes. I mean, the change in the last 5 years is just, you know, remarkable. Okay, we'll get fully into a full religiosity of it again. Because even you start saying that person's immoral because they have a different political thought than you, okay, you're only a hop, skip, and a jump from, you know, burning at the stake. I mean, you know, it does, like they, remember, they just pointed out, it's just a quick little step, right,
yeah.
To full on. Because your sixth adjutant, you know, doesn't bridle easily, takes you right to the rails. Okay, all right, what else we have here?
Gifts and bribes are given to men, but when tendered to the gods, they are described as being dedicated, made sacred, or are called sacrifices. Renunciation was the negative form of propitiation. Sacrifice became the positive form. The act of propitiation included praise, glorification, flattery, and even entertainment. And it is the remnants of these positive practices of the olden propitiation cult that constitute the modern forms of divine worship. Present-day forms of worship are simply the ritualization of these ancient sacrificial techniques of positive propitiation.
Okay, see, now it should be getting, wait a minute, I think you're trying to take away my most cherished notion here. Now, so let's drop back. I mean, in your first reading that, it's like, what are they talking about? This isn't sacrifice, this is worship. Praise, glorification. No, think about it. Why is that sacrifice? What fundamentally are you as an animal origin creature? An incessantly clamoring, inescapable self, seeking recognition and honor, right? You play this game with yourself that God doesn't innately warrant praise, but he demands sacrifice. I mean, technically, I'm the one, right, that should be getting praise. That should be me, right? I should be in the seat of honor. Right, that's what the animal says in you, okay? But you're willing to praise God as a sacrifice, but just, deep down, it's going to be begrudging. It's like, really, people should be praising me. What is God?
After all, God.
Right? It's just we're just so hopeless like this. It's just an insidious phenomenon. All right, so remember why they brought up the whole feasting, sacrificial feasting and all that? So that you could appreciate, the entertainment thing. I'm singing praise songs, because that's delightful to the Lord. Okay? And, actually, they the songs should be about me and not about God, so it's a sacrifice, too. So I'm doing my duty, See, this is pretty ruthless, like I was saying. I mean, what it's doing. And you're going, so what the hell is worship? Pardon the extreme, right? But
that's how I get my allowance.
But that's what you should be saying at this point. I mean, and of course that's the point. I mean, like I was saying up front, there isn't anything that anyone has ever labeled worship that's genuine worship. Like they're pointing out here, because it's all outer life stuff, right? It's not genuine worship. Right? It's not the thing that you finally get to when you take that other fork in the road that go up through prayer, transcend prayer into thanksgiving, and finally transcend through thanksgiving to genuine worship. Right? We're on the other path. You can't get to genuine worship on that other path.
Some people.
Again, it's there by grace superconsciously in everyone, right? And in some people, the shadow that's cast down into their conscious mind, if you're insightful, you can see there's a subtlety to that individual that bespeaks of them being not purely bottom-up, okay, but they're unwitting worshipers. And that's the key. The revelation is trying to get us to back up, take that other path, and become a witting worshiper, instead of just an unwitting worshiper, because we've taken that totally separate path that eventually culminates. We are grown eventually up through prayer and thanksgiving to genuine worship. Remember what genuine worship is. It's on the sixth level of meaning, the level where if anyone had really been consciously there, you could look up the proper definition of the word faith in the dictionary. But you can't, okay? This genuine worship is right there with that genuine faith. It's not in the dictionary. So obviously genuine worship isn't in the dictionary either, okay? It's not reverence. It's not veneration. No matter how sublime the reverence, it's still not worship. That's sixth adjutant. You're four levels short of the sixth level of meaning. So, you know, that to just being have the courage to let go of trying to satisfy yourself with old school worship, and just be willing to just be in a neutral state for a while. Go back to that little child. Enter the kingdom of heaven as that little child that doesn't know anything about genuine worship. Okay? Stop thinking you know something about worship. The little child that Jesus said is the key to the kingdom doesn't know anything about worship. Start back at the beginning and let yourself be grown, right? Into that adult of God that knows worship, right? That has the amazing discovery that worship isn't anything that humans ever thought it was. Worship is thinking the truth. That technically the word philosophize means worship. And that the masters of philosophy on the Isle of Paradise teach you how to worship. Right?
Well, thank God I'll learn it sometime.
Right. Right. You'll learn it. You'll learn it at that high level.
Not too late.
I mean, yeah, you won't have to wait to, you know, learn it from the master. You know, the masters of philosophy just allow you to, you know, take that worship to an initial absolute essence, so it can resonate with absolute beings. Okay, but you'll get it on a finite level long before that, right? I mean, you can really set your sights to beginning this sort of stuff consciously on the third mansion world. When you finally liberated yourself from all this animal origin, you know, material confusion, okay, of body and mind.
It seemed like there was some description about that was just part of the daily routine in that culture, mansion culture.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, once you've, you know, taken the concrete galoshes off of your feet, to use an old Scotty expression from an old Star Trek, right? So that you're not being weighed down.
That's why the transporter.
Right? Once you free yourself from those shackles, those boat anchors, spirit gravity just takes you right up. Right? You don't have to climb. It isn't some sort of, you know, self-help technique you have to learn or something. No, I mean, spirit gravity just naturally lifts you up there. You find yourself in worship, right? Not reaching for it. You're in it.
How do we balance being here now and moving that direction? I mean, we don't want to be so heavenly minded that we're no earthly good, mm-hmm. and we want to have both feet on the ground here and remain tethered.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we want to, you know, be as little child and progress properly.
Again, just you don't have to be childish. So, in other words, you can still render unto Caesar's what is Caesar's, as a biologic adult that, you know, isn't, you know, literally like a 6-year-old. But just, you know, initially you probably will have to kind of compartmentalize, if you will, you know, set aside. It'll be difficult to do both at the same time. To begin with. So you have to start out, it's like, okay, when there aren't material demands on the boss wants me to, you know, get this document done by 5 o'clock or whatever, when that's not pressing on you, you know, set aside a little time where you see if you can let go of the outer life, let go of all material concerns, all your feelings about material issues. Like, I'm worried about grandma, she's getting older. You got to let go of all that stuff, right? And see if you can find that inner life that has no temporal stuff in it. Okay? Yeah, like I said, you'll probably have to kind of go off to the mountaintop initially. Okay? But what you're striving for, once you've found it, is more and more to be able to be the two at the same time. You know, and have an inner life at the same time you have an outer life. And eventually what that leads to is a super additive consequence, right? Where something that's transcendent of both what's initially kind of a dichotomous inner life, outer life being is something totally different, something that is that brings all of the objectivity of the inner life directly present in every moment of your outer life. And it isn't in a, you know, you don't have to pull back on the reins on one and consider the other for a second and then try to put it into play. It's just naturally there. The oil and water have somehow mixed, right? And you just are a very different being. You do what Jesus did with people when he was a third circler going around the Mediterranean, right? Where it's like, well, you know, when I look at it, it looks like it's an outer life, but it's not an outer life I'm familiar with. This is a different sort of an outer life that he has. Where does that sort of an outer life come from? Right? That's a cosmically conscious person. Yeah.
And that you just said, does that go all the way up?
Yeah, and of course that just, you know, has higher and higher levels of realization, you know, throughout endless cycles of eternity. Right? You will constantly be finding a new engagement of the two poles of differential and bringing them together in a ever yet higher super additive consequence, all the way up through the finite, through supremacy, all the way up through absonity, you know, through ultimacy, and all the way to the heights of co-absoluteness bordering directly upon absoluteness, right? That's your whole life. All right, where on earth were we? That's right. We were off in eternity there for a second. So, like I said, see, like I told you, we have this propitiation is kind of this basic idea. All right, you want God working in your favor, and it starts out as a negative notions to get him working in your favor, and then you get more fancy and you come up with positive notions. You know, he'll help me with my parking space if I praise him during the worship service on Sunday. Okay? And so there you dutifully go and you do your best to be emotional and praiseful, right? Yeah.
It works every time. And
okay. We always pick on the parking space thing, yeah. But you know, you get the idea. A lot of times it's a very sincere, profound thing that you desire. But you know, think about it. I mean, it makes you feel icky that grandma is sick, and you'd like to not feel icky anymore. So you try to figure out what you do to get God to be in your favor in this regard. So grandma isn't sick anymore and you don't feel icky anymore.
Well, you feel sad.
Yeah. Right. You know, and again, it's not that you shouldn't feel sad. It just, that's your material life. Don't delude that into a spiritual life. Right? It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Okay.
Animal sacrifice meant much more to primitive man than it could ever mean to modern races. These barbarians regarded the animals as their actual and near kin. As time passed, man became shrewd in his sacrificing, ceasing to offer up his work animals. At first, he sacrificed the best of everything, including his domesticated animals.
Okay, and you're thinking, well, this is like pretty deceitful, isn't it? You know, wink, wink, you know, this is still a valid sacrifice. But you'll see there's a rationalization scheme that comes in the final paragraph. how it is that this doesn't feel like you're trying to pull one over on God. How you're still giving him the, notice best is italicized there, you're still giving him the best. You just had to rethink it to figure out what was really the best part. Okay.
Right. Yeah,
we have, we all know the whole scheme there, right? Now, before we read this famous list, remind the reader, if it's not there in the copy you're looking at, when you get to that final one in this long list of big numbers, that's not sacks of coin, that's sacks of corn, in the sense of the word corn, meaning grain. That's sacks of grain. Okay, it's obviously not maize. We're not talking about that kind of corn, right? This is old world, obviously. This is Egypt, okay? Right, but it's sacks of grain. That's just a typo, that it's coin. It should be corn. Okay? All right, so go ahead and read it.
It was no empty boast that a certain Egyptian ruler made when he stated that he had sacrificed 113,433 slaves, 493,386 head of cattle, 88 boats, 2,756 golden images, 331,702 jars of honey and oil, 228,380 jars of wine, 680,714 geese, 6,744,428 loaves of bread, and 5,740,352 sacks of corn. And in order to do this, he must needs have sorely taxed his toiling subjects.
Notice that the English of that final sentence reminds you why it says corn and should have said corn instead of grain. You can see it's in an English mode. The Brits are still, will call, use that term corn, like we say barley corn. Right, or even peppercorn. Okay. All right. That's general sense of the word corn. We look at it, it's a wheat field, but they'll say it's a corn field because by corn they mean that's the staple grain in that region. So like if it's in England, it's wheat. If it's in Scotland, maybe it's oats, right? But they're all corn fields. Okay.
I'd like to know who's making these loaves of bread.
The slaves before they were sacrificed.
I know they didn't want to make the bread, they were sacrificed.
Yes. And you can pick your favorite one to feel sad about. Maybe it's the wine. but obviously they're just pulling that out of a human source work, as an example, like they say, it's no empty boast, right? They're just pointing out it literally, the sixth adjutant literally took it to that kind of extreme, right? That's not, adjutants 1 through 5. No, that's only the sixth adjutant can get you to 5 million blah, blah, blah sacks of grain, okay? Nothing can do that except the sixth adjutant as the energy of zeal, okay?
Sheer necessity eventually drove these semi-savages to eat the material part of their sacrifices, the gods having enjoyed the soul thereof. And this custom found justification under the pretense of the ancient sacred meal, a communion service according to modern usage.
Okay, the first part, wait a minute, fetishism. Remember, that's one of our predicates. It's the soul of it. That's the best part. I mean, what were we thinking? We eat the material part. God eats the soul part. Okay? So, it took more clever rationalization, and it took the natural development of fetishism, right, to get out of this mode of, you know, burying everything under the sun, right, in the name of sacrifice, burning it or whatever. So these, you know, as we've seen many times, this sort of, you know, it may not be very consciously selfish, but it's selfish mode of man allows us to progress in spite of ourselves, because something has got to get us out of this mode. All right? And so it's handy to begin with to be fogged by much thinking. It'll actually makes it so that we can kind of keep things rolling forward unwittingly. But eventually you have to clear yourself of that fog. And that's what the fifth epical revelation is obviously speaking to. And then, of course, you're starting to get another little, wait a minute, I think they just were touching upon sacred ground there. Are you saying that a communion service is some sort of evolution of a primitive rationalization scheme? What about Jesus' remembrance supper? Yeah, remember, revelation is evolutional, not revolutional. Right? So, you know, especially, you know, in many ways, Jesus is still staying in the post-Adamic stage. You know, God is the Most High and what have you. Okay? He's not being very revolutionary like the fifth epical revelation is, you know, in a lot of ways. You know? So, he's going to, you know, he's not going to try to divorce everyone of where they are. Their ideas of God. Remember, he said, now don't forget about the ideas of God. I'm just trying to bring forth the ideal of God. He's going to kind of let them be with their ideas. He'll try to clean them up a bit, quote unquote, purify them a little bit. And you can kind of get people to purify in the name of religion. They'll purify. They think that's religious, right? So they'll purify their material notions, clean them up, you know, straighten them out, and, you know, give them that, you know, you got to give them something to feel reverent about, because that's the natural evolutionary state. But if you can free it from some of its bondage to simplistic material notions, it can be a stepping stone. You know, upon that purified reverence, maybe you can take that leap of faith and genuinely get a hold of a religion of the Spirit. You know, it is possible, because remember, if you actually jump up to genuine worship, it turns around and you will, your reverence on the second level of meaning will be born again. Right? There'll be a new top-down reverence. You know, and replace that old bottom-up reverence. Okay, so, yeah, but just, you know, yeah, notice that there is even a challenge to what Jesus did here in the fifth epical revelation. It's saying, okay, don't think of that as an end in itself, right? That was just, he was attempting a new beginning for you 2,000 years ago. You can go up from there. All right, let's get into the meaty part here. Pardon the pun.
Section 5, sacrifices and cannibalism. Modern ideas of early cannibalism are entirely wrong. It was a part of the mores of early society. While cannibalism is traditionally horrible to modern civilization, it was a part of the social and religious structure of primitive society. Group interests dictated the practice of cannibalism. It grew up through the urge of necessity and persisted because of the slavery of superstition and ignorance. It was a social, economic, religious, and military custom.
Wow. Pretty complete lifestyle solution sort of a custom, in other words. Okay, but notice how it starts. Okay, I mean, that's the key part, you know, because we do this all the time these days, judging the people of the past by current standards, right? And notice how strong it is. Modern ideas, so-called modern ideas, of early cannibalism are not incorrect, not wrong. They're entirely wrong. In other words, your thoughts are evil. Right? See? It's like, what do you mean they're evil? You're making them evil. They were not evil. Doesn't matter how much you feel like you should condemn them to hell for their iniquity. No. They weren't evil. Your thoughts that they're evil are evil. That's an interesting little turnaround that they're doing there at the beginning. So that's how they start, putting it on you. Because you're immediately wanting to put it on them. You know, those damn cannibals. No, you're the one that's got the issue. God loved them, absolutely. Right? And that gets a little bit tougher as we keep reading here. If you remember that God loved them, absolutely. And the celestials didn't intervene to stop any of this. Right?
Doesn't mean we should do it today.
If it makes a comeback, then... It's the early keto diet.
Right. There is that reminder, you know, of just how ugly it could get if we go back to the beginning. You know, this is obviously what's between the lines of this, right? Yeah. But, yeah, let's keep going. Mm-hmm.
Early man was a cannibal. He enjoyed human flesh, and therefore he offered it as a food gift to the spirits and his primitive gods. Since ghost spirits were merely modified men, and since food was man's greatest need, then food must likewise be a spirit's greatest need.
It's undeniable. I mean, how can you argue with that? It's airtight rationalization. Now, there might be a problem with the initial assumption, right? But there's no problem with the deductive reasoning. It's rock solid, right? So-called deductive reasoning, right? And it's just, yeah, see, it's rational, but it's not reasonable. And it's certainly not logical. Yeah, but just, you know, remember we've seen that before. Don't start thinking that just because they're cannibals, you know, they aren't children of God and, you know, and aren't trying to have a, you know, an apparently logical picture here. Right? They've got it all figured out. They, you know, it all makes sense. All seems to be internally consistent.
So those people in Africa that are starving, those little kids and stuff, they haven't gone back to
them. We're gonna see, you know, how this works. You know, why is it that, you know, they're saying it's so natural? Why doesn't it revert really quickly? I forgot to mention that. Reminded me. Notice in that previous paragraph where it said it grew up through the urge of necessity. Mm-hmm. As we'll see in a second. Don't just think in terms of I'm starving to death because, you know, all the crops failed or something. That's not the only necessity. Matter of fact, that's the minor necessity that they're talking about there. So we need to read here a little bit and see what this urge of necessity is. It's not just that simple one. Okay.
Cannibalism was once well nigh universal among the evolving races. The Sangiks were all cannibalistic, but originally the Andonites were not. Nor were the Nodites and Adamites. Neither were the Andites until after they had become grossly admixed with evolutionary races.
Okay, so in other words, it's totally part of every world, right? It's the Sangiks that are really naturally in this mode. Every world's got Sangiks. Every world starts out with cannibalism. You know, it should be obvious why the Nodites and the Adamites, you know, and the early Andites even weren't. I mean, they have a more enlightened mind, okay, that is just naturally above such thoughts. But you go, well, wait a minute, the Andonites have a lower mind than the Sangiks. Why wasn't it natural for them? Well, remember, they're so low that they can't get that complicated in their thinking to come up with why this is necessary. Remember, I told you there's more to it than just food, the lack of food. Right? There's a notion that this is necessary, that the Andonites aren't sophisticated enough to come up with that notion. Remember, they can't even conceive of grandchildren, right? Okay. They're pretty simple. Right, so that's why they weren't. They're not sophisticated enough. They really can't get above their thoughts enough to make their thoughts that fancy. Right? Thoughts don't get fancy until you can kind of really can get above them and start really playing them. You know, look, I can tie it into this fancy knot, you know, and this sort of stuff. When you're down into it, it doesn't get fancy very easily. Okay.
The taste for human flesh grows, having been started out through hunger, friendship, revenge, or religious ritual. The eating of human flesh goes on to habitual cannibalism. Man-eating has arisen through food scarcity, though this has seldom been the underlying reason. The Eskimos and early Andonites, however, seldom were cannibalistic except in times of famine. The red men, especially in Central America, were cannibals. It was once a general practice for primitive mothers to kill and eat their own children in order to renew the strength lost in childbearing. And in Queensland, the first child is still frequently thus killed and devoured. In recent times, cannibalism has been deliberately resorted to by many African tribes as a war measure, a sort of frightfulness with which to terrorize their neighbors.
Okay. So notice in the first part there, you know, how they're stressing that the first thing that comes to mind is, okay, everyone's starving to death. And they resort to cannibalism. That is the minor issue, right? And it's the only reason that the Andonites see got to it. Again, you know, everyone, even if they're an Andonite, eventually gets so hungry, you know, right? You know, everyone knows that you can be pushed to that. It's the most foundational urge you have, you know, hunger. So obviously, it can be driven that far. But the necessity is not mostly that. Mostly, the necessity is these other things, right? See, it's not just hunger, it's friendship, revenge, or religious ritual. Right? I need to do this in the name of friendship. I need to do this in the name of revenge. I need to do this in the name of, you know, religiosity. That's the urge of necessity. You know, and see, just reminding you, it's an urge. You know, religious ritual, that's not an urge, that's a high spiritual thing. No, it's the urge of the sixth adjutant. Right. So, you know, and they mentioned the African tribes as a war measure, right? I mean, see, that's the revenge thing. Right? You know, and it's, and just add that element that you can't really do naturally right now. You know, it's not just, oh, I'm going to do this just to really get at them. No, you feel you need to do this. Right? It's your duty. Right? If you can kind of get back to that more primitive mode, right, and you know, not think so complexly about it. You know, it's just a think in an urge sense where you're just driven this way, the way you've sort of framed your mind. I have to do this. I have no choice, right? I mean, if I don't eat my friend, I mean, that's just the end of everything. I mean, I have to do this. I mean, I'll do whatever it takes to get to that end, right? I mean, you're thinking in that mode. It's a full-on necessity. All right, so you can see how complicated it is to be in that middle ground of the Sanghics. Complicated enough, right, to think of such unfortunate notions, but not, you know, yet complicated, more a little more complicated to where you go, oh, wait, what am I thinking here? That's
I don't
want to
be here.
Right. So, yeah, that's where the Sanghics are. Yeah, it kind of adds. It kind of adds to the fact that the revelators coined them as Sanghics, right? You know, bloodline producing, you know, is the immediacy of that, you know. But the fact that there's blood there, yeah, you see how naturally they're in that state.
So as you're reading through all this,
because, you know, it sounds like this lasted for quite a long period of time.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Hundreds of thousands, a long time.
Yeah, yeah, as we'll start to play out here, right? I mean, you know, as they're pointing out,
it's a natural phenomenon.
It's a completely natural. So unless something unnatural changes it, it goes on and on and on. Something unnatural like a biologic uplift or an Edenic teaching or a Dalmatian teaching or a Jesus teaching or a Melchizedek teaching, right? I mean, it's only revelatory influence, right, or literal biologic uplift that's going to change this natural state. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just inescapable. All right.
Some cannibalism resulted from the degeneration of once superior stocks, but it was mostly prevalent among the evolutionary races. Man-eating came on at a time when men experienced intense and bitter emotions regarding their enemies. Eating human flesh became a part of a solemn ceremony of revenge. It was believed that an enemy's ghost could, in this way, be destroyed or fused with that of the eater. It was once a widespread belief that wizards attained their powers by eating human flesh.
Remember how they mentioned, you know, someone is ingenious, right? That fetishistic concept that the genius is in them. Well, if you're in a very basic material mode, literal mode, right, the only way to get the genius in is to eat it.
You know, okay. If we're all came from the Sangiks, we have, we probably have that in our DNA.
All of us have this naturally, right? And, you know, and if, you know, think about how we don't do it literally anymore, but we delight in contemplating it metaphorically. I'm going to eat you alive.
I've heard people say that.
Right, when you're doing, you know, the revenge thing. Mm-hmm. See, that's just, they literally, in the back, they ate them, literally, and we still have that expression. You know, it's just, we just evolved it from, you know, literal to metaphoric. Okay. All right, but see, that tells you that urge is there. The fact that you want to say that to someone, right? You know, and here they're also bringing out that, you know, why you think you need to do this. You know, you got the ghost fear stuff and whatnot. I mean, this is a solemn ceremony. Okay, I mean, this is the best religiosity that they can muster. This is not, you know, this is not evil, whatnot. You know, this is solemn. This is as solemn as any ceremony in any cathedral today, right? It's solemn. You know, so they're in that mode. This is done in reverence, you know, and that those energies are in play.
Eating your own children, though, kind of go against something else deeper inside.
Yeah, I don't know how they could have done that. That's a strange.
Yeah, well, that we've talked. Remember, we talked about that back in the marriage and family papers. Right. Yeah, the maternal instinct is very powerful. But remember, there's none so blind as those who will not see. I mean, don't forget that you can, if you bring in your personality to fire up an ideology, I mean, you can overcome even the most foundational biologic urge.
Mm-hmm. That's right? What's happening right now with the children.
So, yeah. I mean, it obviously takes a lot, but that's just reminding you, they were that devout. Right, they were that fired up that even the women were burrowing all the way down to the bottom of their biologic nature and overcoming their maternal instinct. Yeah. So, you know, if religion, you know, quote unquote religion can do that, it can, you know, it can do anything. Don't be surprised. You know, what might be done in the name of religion. All right, but anyway, yeah, like the back to here, the whole solemn ceremony of revenge. They have a very, you know, they need to do this. I mean, if we don't do this, I mean, that ghost is going to be running amok. It's going to, I mean, you know, it'll be calamity for the entire tribe. This, you know, this has to be done. Right.
Yep. So you're talking about this, you know, eating. I mean, it kind of reminded me of the whole, Last Supper, this is my body, which is served for you. And people literally think that when...
Of course, right.
When they eat this, they get Jesus inside them.
You're jumping ahead, though. That's coming up. Yeah, obviously we're moving towards that, right? Yeah, it's just a little tweak of abstraction and rationalization from the literalness in the Mithraic cult to Christianity, right? all right.
Certain groups of man-eaters would consume only members of their own tribes, a pseudo-spiritual inbreeding which was supposed to accentuate tribal solidarity. But they also ate enemies for revenge with the idea of appropriating their strength. It was considered an honor to the soul of a friend or fellow tribesman if his body were eaten, while it was no more than just punishment to an enemy thus to devour him. The savage mind made no pretensions to being consistent.
Okay, so, you know, that's the key at the end. I mean, don't be surprised if these rationalization schemes can be quite ad hoc, right? no one is stepping back, wait a minute, those are not consistent rationalization schemes, right? And it's like, boy, I'm glad that humans aren't like that anymore. Have you looked at science? They've got a rationalization scheme in solid-state physics, and they've got a rationalization scheme in particle physics. It all works fine. And step back, it's like, wait a minute, the fundamental assumptions of those two schemes are inconsistent. It's really no different than these primitives. It just appears to be fancier. But in terms of reality, it's exactly the same because it's not philosophic. It's not consistent. So the details are really irrelevant, whether it's cannibalism or particle physics. You're equally apart from that space where you can know God. Man, really know God.
Among some tribes, aged parents would seek to be eaten by their children. Among others, it was customary to refrain from eating near relations. Their bodies were sold or exchanged for those of strangers.
Substitution.
There was considerable commerce in women and children who had been fattened for slaughter. When disease or war failed to control population, the surplus was unceremoniously eaten.
See, like I've said many times, overpopulation isn't really a problem. It really can't happen. All right, if it's not a disease, and war and stuff. Right, I mean, eventually it gets bad enough. You go back to the primitive mode and you just eat the, the surplus. Between the lines is it definitely wasn't a problem in the past. It won't ever be a problem in the future either. You're never really going to have an overpopulation problem, right? There's a vast conspiracy. It'll naturally take care of itself. People will just die off for whatever reason. And you'll be back to an appropriate population. It's the way it works.
I mean, it could be like, for instance, when they take the babies that come out of the mother and let them die, and then they sell their body parts and stuff, all that stuff. Okay, I can see that's kind of like this thing.
Sure, yeah.
I can see that part. Right. Right. But to actually, because overpopulation and then start eating each other?
No. We're not going to start eating each other. No, I'm not saying that. I said exactly the opposite. Oh, we're not going to obviously do that like the primitives did.
Oh.
But inescapably, right, disease and famine and right whatnot will fix the problem.
Well, Buckminster Fuller said, naturally, we'll just stop having less children.
Right. I mean, one way or another, to get super existential about overpopulation is silly, right? Sure, you can wish for us to be wiser and not have to have, 2 billion people die of disease or something to solve the problem, right? But, to think that the problem won't be solved and that humans will just die off, it's like, no, humans are not going to die off in toto. Right, designed it so that that doesn't happen. All right, the herd will just get culled. And it always has been that way. But anyway, you know, back to this, back to cannibalism. You know, the fascinating thing is it, literally cannibalism played a role in this, you know, back in the day. All right.
Cannibalism has been gradually disappearing because of the following influences. One, it sometimes became a communal ceremony, the assumption of collective responsibility for inflicting the death penalty upon a fellow tribesman. The blood guilt ceases to be a crime when participated in by all, by society. The last of cannibalism in Asia was this eating of executed criminals.
Okay. Yellow man did it. Okay, not just red man in Central and South America or something. Right? Every Sangic did it. The thing I want to say up front here, so that you aren't kind of knitting your brow as we read these too much, to get you in the proper frame. You're going, wait a minute, the cannibalism has been gradually disappearing because of, okay, isn't this just like another reason to eat people? How is this making it disappear? But you know, think about it, step back a little bit. There, you have various notions that come up that make it less and less of an individual universal phenomenon, right? So it gets mitigated slowly by some notion that it's like this. It's not allowed for every individual, but you know, if you go into collectivist mode, then it's okay. Okay, you know, anything that makes it something that you where you reduce the number of people that can be cannibalistic for some notion, or the number of times that you could be cannibalistic for some notion, right? In one way or another, it lessens. That's what all these are about. You know, none of them are outlawing cannibalism. You know, you're just tempering the phenomenon, you know, to some degree. And so it just naturally lessens and lessens, and then Revelation steps in and really, you know, puts the finishing touches on it, and you know, and it disappears. Okay.
Number two, it very early became a religious ritual, but the growth of ghost fear did not always operate to reduce man eating.
See, that one, see, is a problem. It's like, well, okay, it's only to be done as a religious ritual, but you know, the exquisiteness of ghost fear, you know, may actually end up making it more frequent, you know, than just the fact that everyone developed a habitual taste for human flesh. You know, as we saw, your sixth adjutant takes all the natural things to an extreme. So that's what they're pointing out there. This actually sometimes made it worse, but not always. Sometimes it actually made it better. The religious energy was tempered enough that, you know, you can not allow it. It's taboo to do it in general, but it's okay to do it as a religious ritual, so it happened less.
Number three, it eventually progressed to the point where only certain parts or organs of the body were eaten. Those parts supposed to contain the soul or portions of the spirit. Blood drinking became common, and it was customary to mix the, quote, edible parts of the body with medicines.
I've seen those quote-unquote edible parts. Those are the ones that that the taboo doesn't apply to, right? You know, all of it can, you know, literally be eaten, but you're not allowed to eat anything except the quote-unquote edible parts, edible in that sense.
Right, the ribeyes.
Yeah, whatever, yeah. The bacon strips. this is leading towards what I was, you know, when you were bringing up, you know, your Christian issues and stuff. See, notice how we're refining, you know, again, it's like, remember we talked about this before. What is going on that they're getting more sophisticated, and they're not just thinking, well, it's a blob, it's all the same. They're starting to focus in, there's different parts, and oh, this is the special part, only this part has the soul. That's a budding scientific consciousness, right? You know, you're getting more focused and precise. It's not your unity consciousness that just blurs it all out, right? So in between the lines of that is something we saw before, where they're getting more precise and stuff that. So you eventually have a more refined individuality consciousness to go with that unity consciousness, and you can put the two together. Just in the most crude of ways, this develops so that eventually you'll have the three centuries of the Enlightenment.
Number four, it became limited to men. Women were forbidden to eat human flesh.
Yeah, and think about how in contrasting that is to men oppressing women. Right? I mean, it's right there in line. Women don't have to serve in the military. Notice that we instinctually give women a higher natural estate than men. Because, of course, the hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny. Even those primitives had a sense of that. You know, if they're going to think of someone as being somehow innately apart from crudeness, right? Man is sort of crude incarnate. Female is refined, right? We pick up on that very early on. You might subsequently think, have some rationalization scheme why they're forbidden to eat. But, why did you point to them and come up with a rationalization scheme instead of to men? Because they're just naturally more refined, and worthy of coming up with a rationalization scheme for why they're forbidden. Yeah.
Number five, it was next limited to the chiefs, priests, and shamans.
Okay, so now it's really boiling down. I mean, first just men, and now just, the handful of men that are the special ones. And the between the lines of that one as well. That's what makes them chiefs, priests, and shamans. It's like the wizards, right? I mean, they have to have the spirit infused into them, or how could they possibly be a leader? So you can obviously see the fetishism idea is holding on, white knuckle here. Very difficult to finally totally liberate yourself from the idea that shouldn't someone be ingesting the soul of this so that they're a great person?
Number six, then it became taboo among the higher tribes. The taboo on man-eating originated in Dalmatia and slowly spread over the world. The Nadites encouraged cremation as a means of combating cannibalism, since it was once a common practice to dig up buried bodies and eat them.
Yum, yum. There's the revelatory influences. So the Dalmatia teachings, began to temper this. Obviously, like they tell you, things would have been progressing for 300,000 years, and then the rebellion, and it would have gone completely back to square one again, and it would have been cannibalism everywhere again in very short order. As you can tell, the Nadites are, cremating, because of the ubiquitousness of cannibalism. So, it would have gotten, very much revelatory tempering again with Adam and Eve. There would have been a long span there of 150,000 years where it would have been a very cannibalistic Mad Max world, like they tell you back there in the wake of the rebellion.
Okay. Number seven, human sacrifice sounded the death knell of cannibalism. Human flesh having become the food of superior men, the chiefs, it was eventually reserved for the still more superior spirits. And thus, the offering of human sacrifices effectively put a stop to cannibalism, except among the lowest tribes. When human sacrifice was fully established, man-eating became taboo. Human flesh was food only for the gods. Man could eat only a small ceremonial bit, a sacrament.
Yeah, so there it is. See, it's the culmination. Like I said, all this stuff is building up to the latest, you know, rationalization scheme. Yeah, so of course, the list of seven culminates in that, that you've got this little sacred, you know, sacrament, a sacred element, right? And remember, you got to this earlier, you got to the preciseness where you could refine this down like that, right? And not be thinking whole body. Yeah, I mean, you know, and you were obviously literally in that sacrament mode with Mithraism, right? You were literally eating body and literally drinking blood. You know, like, remember, blood drinking got in there a few notches back here. You know, so the refinement is, okay, we don't literally, you know, carve off a chunk of Jesus's body and drink a little cup of his blood because we're saving him or something, like we were vampires. But we still have to believe that there's some magic thing that happens, you know, transubstantiation, where the soul of it is literally Jesus. See, remember, it was important to develop that earlier on. You know, that, so, you know, that transubstantiation is, that's fetishism, right? And the literalness of that, you know, you believe that the outside is, you know, you don't literally think that this is blood. I mean, you know that it's materially wine, but the soul of the wine, because of what the priest did, is now literally Jesus. And you're literally eating his soul. And, you know, in the drinking of, you know, eating the bread and drinking the blood. Right? And then it, you know, it was a further refinement to let go of transubstantiation. You know, and just say, no, it's just a symbol. And remember, humans went through that same process way, way back. Right? You know, first they're literally worshiping the rock. Then they're worshiping the soul in the rock. And then eventually, there's no soul in the rock, but the rock is a handy symbol of something else, right? The real God on high or whatever. And see, so he, you know, we went through that same process with the sacrament, but again, you could say, well, how about just letting go of that whole, you know, instead of just ever more refining the notion, making it less and less literal and more abstract and symbolic? Well, they tell you in the book, most people can't. They need a symbol. So most people can't take that next step where you just let go of it, right? And go to some real concept instead of an ever more refined illusion. So that gets back to the beginning I was telling you. See, that's what this is all leading up, right? They go through this whole history, and then they sort of, there's a pregnant pause between the lines in the fifth epical revelation. Are you one of those that can take that next step and actually just let go of all matter-based illusions that you call spiritual? Right? Where you don't need any sacraments, you don't need any sacred elements. Can you take that step? It's not bad if you can't, but, you know, fundamentally, the fifth epical revelation is putting that question out. Are you one of those few that could just let go of that and venture out into unexplored territory in search of genuine spirit? Remember, Jesus started out thinking he could get people to take that step, and more he recognized, no, I can't get them to take that step. So he finally, I'm going to have to just try to, you know, take it from, you know, 500,000 taboos to a couple or something. I mean, he's going to try to pare it down, purify it a little bit, simplify it. I mean, he knew that was the best he could achieve because he's trying to do it without the proper biologic uplift and no magisterial son in advance of it. I mean, what he's trying to do is impossible, right? He's got to come again, finish the process. But the fifth epical revelation knows that there are a few people on the planet that could take that step. You're going to be very lonely, you know, kind of to begin with, because most people know. You've got to really step out in that parallel stream to do this, you know, and not need all sorts of rituals and ceremonials and solemn, you know, doings and whatnot. Yeah. All right, let's wrap it up here.
Finally, animal substitutes came into general use for sacrificial purposes. And even among the more backward tribes, dog eating greatly reduced man eating. The dog was the first domesticated animal and was held in high esteem both as such and as food.
Okay, so when all is said and done, we've got one of those things where, you know, besides revelation, a couple of things really helped to finally get rid of cannibalism. They took the step forward to human sacrifice. You're like, that's a step forward? Okay, in relative terms, it is. That's an improvement over cannibalism. And dog eating.
And still done.
Right? To just, you know, and obviously, you know, we know for some people on the planet today, dog eating is worse than human eating, right? I mean, that's more of a taboo violation for many. You know, so in both cases, you can be, you know, revolted by this. But they're going to get you to think, okay, but it's a step forward. It's a step forward to eat dogs instead of animals. I mean, instead of humans, you know, to eat animals instead of humans. You know, just like it's a step forward to sacrifice animals instead of humans, you know, like the whole, you know, a bit with Abraham, you know, and human sacrifice there, you know. And so, you see, when all is said and done there, you end up with human sacrifice at this point and dog eating. And it all feels pretty yucky still.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's why you need to go back to the first thing we read. Modern ideas of early cannibalism are entirely wrong. Okay? Are you enough in the presence of fatherly love, in contrast to brotherly love, that you cannot look down on the people we're reading about here? God loves all these people absolutely that are eating the dogs and sacrificing the humans. The celestials are not intervening because of the horror of it all. This is all natural as it should be. And again, it should remind you, well, how could God possibly love this, you know, human eater or this human sacrificer as much as he loves me? Well, maybe it's because he doesn't give any consideration to your material nature in his love for you. Matter of fact, not only does he not give any consideration to your material nature or your material doings, he gives no consideration to your temporal nature at all. Fatherly love has nothing to do with experience. Like, brotherly love is all about experience. Fatherly love is transcendent of experience. It has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with experience. It's purely existential. God loves everyone because they are. It has nothing to do with what they do or think or anything like that. He loves them simply because they exist. Right? That's fatherly love. That's what you're trying to challenge yourself to get to. Right? to love this horrendous, crude cannibal as much as you might love your favorite saint. Okay. There's no difference in the eyes of the Father. And can you make it so there's no difference in your eyes either? At least in that part that is rendering unto God's what is God's. Sure, it's the part that renders unto Caesar's what is Caesar's notices a difference and has to notice a difference. Right? But the other part is completely separate from that, see?
You can't love somebody you don't know, so love's not the right word in a way, but you know, what you're basically saying is try and understand, you know, the situation.
Can you have an orientation towards them that even if you haven't literally been in their presence, it doesn't matter. You know they exist, and so that orientation is just there. And if you eventually do meet them, that's the predicate. Prior to any experience, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, bottom line, it doesn't matter if your experience with them is pleasant or unpleasant, because you love them with fatherly love. They exist. And that's all that you need. That's what you're trying to strive for. And obviously, it's very difficult to not notice that this person is eating another person. That's going to be a difficult challenge to set that aside. You know, this person is killing, little children. Can I just set that aside and love them with fatherly love? The Father does. Father gives no consideration to such things. I mean, he's not offended by anything that any human does because he has no relationship to anything that they do in time. He knows not of any of that. He's a purely existential being. And that's a great predicate for a real human.
So let's just give everybody an AR-15.
Yeah. Well, see, again, of course not, see, yeah. See, again, the inner life and the outer life are not a dichotomy. You don't have to pick one or the other. Right? You deal with, the mass murderer, relative to law and justice. But it has nothing to do with love and mercy. Didn't Jesus model that with the condemned criminal? Right? Right? Society has a right to execute you. Right? It has nothing to do with love and mercy, the application of love. Right? Can you separate them? Or are you blurring them together and hence losing the truth of both? And if you are blurring them together, well, you've joined the club. That's what almost everyone on the planet is doing. The more quote-unquote spiritual they become, the more they blur the two together. And again, that gets us, that's the bottom line. Because we're doing that, that's why civilization is quivering on the very brink of collapse. If you can't keep those separate, it's going to implode. You must separate those, right? You must not use the word moral for material affairs. Right, but everyone wants to, always has. Right, the material affairs, that's ethical. Moral is different. Moral is an inner life word, not an outer life word. What is morality? What is a moral choice? You can't go to any expert to tell you. No human has figured it out, ever. What is a moral choice? Right? What is the genuine inner life? All right, so we've got cannibalism out of the way, but we have, as you can see, in the next we have a lot. Yeah, yeah. We have a lot more about sacrifice because, of course, we're building up to the full rationalization of sacrifice with Jesus, in the atonement doctrine. But I hope in the midst of the difficult. Some of those difficult things there. you can see that there's much that's relevant to today, and there's much more than meets the eye there. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.